Today on Against the Grain, labor activists and union organizers have played key roles in this nation's history, but so have those who opposed unions and fought organized labor. I'm CS. Historian Chad Pearson discusses his new book, Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. They hated unions. They condemned labor militancy. They wanted a docile and compliant workforce. And they have influenced how people view labor unions for more than a century. They were the anti-union activists of the progressive era. And understanding what they thought and how they acted has been the years-long project of Chad Pearson, an historian based at Collin College in Plano, Texas. We're not just talking about strike-breaking and union-busting here. Many of the activists Pearson studied were engaged in a kind of PR campaign, an effort to persuade policymakers, employers, and the general public of the benefits of non-unionized workplaces. What Pearson discovered, among other things, is the way racism and racial violence affected and inflected anti-union thinking in the American South. Chad Pearson is professor of history at Collin College. His new book is Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. When Chad Pearson joined me recently in studio, I asked him why he chose to focus on those who pushed an anti-union agenda.
I think the chief reason is because they were so powerful. When you think about what employers do, they hire, fire, they decide what benefits, if any, to give, and they have an enormous amount of power. And so there's a kind of a shortage of books about them. There's a lot of labor history about the workers themselves, but less so about the employers, these people who are in these organizations, and they fight unions very aggressively. And I wanted to know more about them and what they did and how they organized.
The title of your book is Reform or Repression. What do those words refer to?
So I wanted to understand how employers identified themselves in the context of the great campaigns in the early 20th century. Many employers, beginning in the period after the Civil War, were concerned about what they called the labor problem, also known as the labor question. And that involved strikes, boycott campaigns, demands for exclusive bargaining rights, that is, closed shops. And employers, they sought to deal with this, and they saw themselves as reformers. They wanted to stop the strikes. They wanted to stop the workers' demand that they have exclusive bargaining rights. And so they put forward this idea of the open shop. And the open shop is this idea that workers should have the right to join or not join a union. And so that sounds great in practice. It sounds good in theory, but in practice, it really means that, you know, employers would treat workers as individuals, and these individuals would not have the kind of bargaining rights that they would have as collective bodies. And so I was very interested in how employers sort of define the labor problem and sought to provide a labor solution. And the labor solution to them was the open shop. During the course of this, though, during strikes and whatnot, they would often bring in strike breakers and bust unions. They had support from the police and other armed guards. And so there was this repressive dimension to it as well. And so the title of my book is Reform or Repression, which really depends on what your perspective is. Certainly we can identify aspects of reform, but we can also see that there's a considerable amount of repression.
So one would think that employers, that the owners and managers of corporations would play the most prominent role, perhaps the key role, the only role in the anti-union movement. Is that correct?
They are the dominant force in anti-unionism, but they were able to build coalitions with other individuals as well, judges, lawyers, clergy members, reformers. My book looks at individuals like Theodore Roosevelt, the president, Louis Brandeis, Washington Gladden, a lot of folks we consider as kind of reformers, progressives, but in fact, they supported the open shop principle, which means support for individualism over collectivism, the right of the non-union worker. And so rather than present the open shop campaign as one of employer versus worker, what I sought to do is to broaden it and show how this was a bigger movement that involved lots of characters, both in and outside of industrial relations.
Brandeis was a lawyer and Washington Gladden was a social gospeler. Well, you mentioned reformers and reform groups, and you suggested, and you write in this book, that many of them actually did not stand up for organized labor and did not approve of labor unions. Tell us about that.
That's right. Traditionally, scholars, historians have talked about what they call a labor-liberal coalition. And they talk about how workers worked with these sort of left-leaning progressives like Brandeis. And I turn it around and point out how these reformers were very supportive of the rights of the non-union worker, what they called the free worker. And so language is really key here. So there's the phrase open shop, right? Open shop sounds much more progressive than closed shop, right, mm-hmm. where you have these sort of exclusive bargaining agreements. The free worker, the idea is that workers are free from, they're not some slave to a union, which is how some of these reformers put it. They also talk a lot about efficiency and how unions undermine efficiency. In the early 20th century, we have the progressive period where folks are very interested in this question of efficiency and whatnot. So so you have this broad spectrum of folks who are very interested in what they call reform, and these ideas often undermine the labor movement.
How did the media and the newspapers in particular portray labor conflicts and picket lines, and what effect did that have on popular attitudes toward labor organizing?
Sure. Most of the media were generally pretty hostile and portrayed unions as sort of out of control, very dangerous. And there's this idea that comes up both in the media and from some of these reformers, and that is that there is no such thing as peaceful picketing. Right. And so this idea that workers can articulate their grievances in a peaceful way is sort of something that's that they don't consider. So they think all protest is out of control. And so we see this in some of the big iconic strikes in the late 19th century. In 1877, the big railroad strike in Haymarket and Pullman in the Gilded Age, where workers are portrayed in the media as just completely out of control. And so the open shop movement is one way to kind of address this, you know, the mobs as the media portray workers.
So what were some of the key associations, the key groups, the key organizations that developed and advanced an anti-labor union agenda?
So there were a number of employer-based organizations. Many cities had their employers groups, the Employers Association of Cleveland, the Employers Association of Worcester, Massachusetts, and many, many cities had these. They also had trade-based groups like those who worked on heavy machinery, the National Metal Trades Association. There were foundry operators who had a group called the National Founders Association. There were big manufacturers, big and small, who joined a group called the National Association of Manufacturers. And all of these groups sort of were, you know, business-based. But they also organized what are called citizens' associations, citizens' alliances. And these were really designed to deflect away from the class position of the activists in these groups. So one of the biggest was the Citizens Industrial Association of America, which was established in 1903. It was included many, many citizens and employers associations. And so the idea was that these are not class-based organizations. They stand for things like law and order. They stand for the rights of the non-union worker. And almost anybody could join. In practice, these organizations were led by, you know, employers, people who had a genuine stake in the outcome of labor management conflicts.
Yeah, you would think that employers, I mean, one major reason that they might be opposed to labor unions and militant labor is that their profits would be disturbed, would be hurt, they would be harmed financially. Is this the kind of thing that they highlighted in their arguments to the general public about why labor unions and labor organizing are dangerous?
No, they tended to draw attention away from their own class interests and generally talked about law and order, talked about the rights of the non-union worker, portrayed unions as un-American. And so they used a combination of patriotism, a desire for greater efficiency, this idea that workers in unions were inefficient, And then, of course, you know, this idea that these non-union folks deserved rights as well. And so very seldom did they talk directly about how unions hurt their bottom line, right? Instead, this was something that was, you know, again, un-American, or, you know, that undermined the rights of individuals.
Chad Pearson is professor of history at Collin College in Texas. He's author of Reform or Repression: Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So you devote different chapters in this book to different case studies and different parts of the country and different people and different movements. One of the chapters is devoted to a guy named N.F. Thompson. And we'll go into this in some depth, but why is this man, Thompson, important to the story you're trying to tell?
N.F. Thompson was probably the most influential anti-union activist in the late 19th and early 20th century in the South, and arguably one of the most important figures nationally. He was born in Middle Tennessee in 1844 to a slaveholding family, and fought in the Civil War as a Confederate under Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a very aggressive Confederate leader. Later, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, the first Ku Klux Klan, an organization that Nathan Bedford Forrest helped lead. And then he was active in the temperance movement. And then at the turn of the century, was involved in the open shop movement. And in 1900, he speaks before the Industrial Commission, this big meeting about the labor problem, and he basically says labor unions constitute the biggest threat to this country, and he calls for what he calls justifiable homicide laws, meaning that workers, non-union workers or employers should have the right to murder those who seek to establish closed shop unions, that is, unions where everybody's a member.
He advocates a justifiable homicide law. Was he laughed off the stage?
No. In fact, the New York Times wrote about him. The Nation magazine praised him aggressively, thought this guy really gets to the heart of the issue. Even some unionists said, well, you know, he deserves thanks for telling the truth because so many other employers were not frank about their interests, and N.F. Thompson was unapologetic.
The lefty, The Nation magazine, praised Mr. N.F. Thompson?
That's right. The Nation, of course, used to, was a very anti-union newspaper for a while in the decades after the Civil War, and only later became more progressive.
So how did N.F. Thompson justify his statement that labor unions constituted a menace, or the greatest menace to society? I mean, what did he believe unions did, or what threat did he say they posed such that, you know, all of the other problems and things facing society paled in comparison to labor organizing?
Well, he saw strikes, which indeed would get violent. He himself ran a printing establishment in the 1870s. He edited a journal called the Riverside Weekly, and a union tried to organize and demanded that his employee join, and his employee apparently didn't want to. The pressure continued, and he finally said, fine, just join. So he felt coerced in that context. He also, you know, he sees that there's all this radicalism. But there's also, he has an interest. He, in the turn of the century, he is a commercial real estate developer called the Thompson Land and Investment Company. And he sees all this labor activism in the North, and basically wants to attract these textile mills and other workplaces to the South, to Huntsville, Alabama, where he lives. And he basically says, hey, look, you know, we don't have problems like that down here. You know, come down and invest here. And basically he tells business owners, investors in the North, you know, you have an option, fight or flight. And so he has, it's arguable that he exaggerates the extent of the labor problem in the North in an effort to secure investment in the South where he will benefit.
So N.F. Thompson, this nationally recognized anti-union activist, he was appointed in 1903 to the organization you mentioned earlier, the Citizens Industrial Association of America, its leadership committee. So this is a national organization. So wouldn't that suggest, wouldn't a leadership role in the CIAA suggest that N.F. Thompson's main objective was stamping out union activity nationwide?
Yeah, and when he goes to New York at their conference, he talks about how we need to have a national movement against unions. But at the same time, he emphasizes that those in the North and the Midwest need to follow the South's example. And he points out that there's all these labor struggles in Colorado. This is during the big coal mine war there. And he points out, problems in Cleveland and basically says, hey, look, you know, we've mastered the solution to the labor problem. And so follow us. But how much he wants national unity, it's unclear. But he certainly benefits in some ways from creating this North-South differential.
So you gave a quick recap of N.F. Thompson's life, and let's talk about it in some detail. So he was born in Shelbyville, Tennessee in 1844. He grew up in that town. His father ran a plantation and owned slaves. What did the young N.F. Thompson notice about the slaves who worked on that property?
In his telling, in 1900, when he nostalgically reflects on it, he talks about how the slaves were very deferential. They were very hardworking. They did their job well. They were treated well by the Thompson family. And so for him, slavery was a time, was a harmonious time, was a time of, kind of the natural way things should have been. And so he doesn't see it as a low point in American society. He fondly recalls that period.
And so maybe this is a foundation for his belief that workers shouldn't be organized and that they should just owe obeisance to their masters, to their employers?
That's right. I can certainly see those connections, absolutely.
And then there was a massive slave revolt, what W.E.B. Du Bois later called a general strike, staged by about 4 million slaves. Tell us about this strike and the impression it made on Thompson.
Sure. So I argue that following W.B. Du Bois' 1935 Black Reconstruction book, that the Civil War was not just a military conflict, but was also a labor rebellion, and that this was a multi-stage, very bloody rebellion. It didn't happen all at once. But in the aftermath of that, the plantation elite, including Thompson, needed to manage that workforce. And so I argue that the Ku Klux Klan, in some ways, was kind of like a pre-industrial employers association. It held members from different classes, but the leadership of the Klan were often privileged planter folks, including Thompson and Nathan Bedford Forrest. And so the tendency when folks talk about the Klan is to highlight hate. I think it's important to talk about exploitation, right? It's not that they hated Black people. They wanted former slaves to get back on the plantations and the farms and work. And so I try to draw connections between the management of these former slaves, these freed people, and the 40 years later, the open shop movement. Thompson was involved in both of those struggles.
So in other words, the Ku Klux Klan was focused on labor discipline as opposed to race hatred? I mean, is that one way to put it?
I don't think the two are necessarily incompatible. I think that certainly racism was central, but the question is, where do they see the role of African Americans? And that role is to work. And those who sought to demonstrate independence, either politically or economically, they felt threatened by. And so the Klan, I argue, in some ways was an organization that served the class as well as the racial interests of the plantation elite.
Who else besides disobedient free blacks did the Ku Klux Klan of Thompson's time target?
They also targeted Republicans. They targeted what they called carpetbaggers. These are Northerners who came south and supported the Republican Party. They opposed teachers, those who sought to educate the freed people. And so the Klan sought to protect as much old-style white supremacy and planter power as possible, and anybody who stood in the way they saw as a threat.
Right. And you write in this book, Reform or Repression, by my guest, Chad Pearson, that the Klan was largely about promoting law and order, defending class and race hierarchies, restoring dignity as they saw it, protecting a traditional way of life. At age 16, N.F. Thompson joined the Confederate Army. What should we know about his participation in that war and why he joined?
I don't know exactly why he joined, but it's plausible that he wanted to defend his way of life, the slave society. He was discharged at age 16, and then he rejoined with Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he fought in a number of the final battles, including one that concluded in April of 1865. That's right around the time when the Confederacy was defeated. And so he was there for the duration of the war.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Chad Pearson joins me in studio. He is a history professor at Collin College, and we are talking about his new book. It's called Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. And right now we're talking about one of the stories Chad tells in his book, the story of the American South's most ambitious and visible opponent of labor unions and labor organizing. His name was N.F. Thompson. So Thompson, at some point, moves from Tennessee to Louisville, Kentucky. What cause does he take up there?
He's very active in the temperance movement. He's opposed to alcohol consumption. He sees it as profoundly immoral. And he edits a newspaper, a very moralistic newspaper, where he talks about the problems of alcoholism, and he's in the Templars organization, it's called, and they were very militant. He was known as one of the great speakers for this cause, and he would go around the country speaking out against it. And so he was very much a reformer, active against alcohol.
And how does his involvement in the temperance movement, how do you think that relates to his views on, labor and race, and later toward union organizing? Is there a connection, a thread running through all of these different causes he got involved in?
Certainly he is interested in order, wants to maintain, peace and order. And so I see his involvement in the temperance movement as sort of part of that broader campaign, against drunkenness and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and this, I guess, was a big movement at the time, right? I mean, and also the sobriety, one could see that maybe as a metaphor for how workers ought to behave, how they ought to conduct themselves, how, they should be sober in every sense of the word in terms of how they conduct themselves and how they carry out their duties for employers.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very true.
Okay. So we've talked about N.F. Thompson and, his dad's plantation, and he joins the Confederate Army. He joins the Ku Klux Klan. He becomes a temperance activist. So what about this anti-union activity? When did that, for N.F. Thompson, begin in earnest, and why?
I think it began probably in the 1880s, 1890s. This is a time of much labor strife nationally, mostly in the North, though not exclusively. N.F. Thompson was a member of the Birmingham Commercial Club. This was an organization. He was living in Birmingham, Alabama at the time, and they were involved in recruiting businesses to Birmingham. And during that time, there's a big coal miner strike not far, and the Birmingham Commercial Club denounced that. But they also denounced the strikes happening in the North. And again, they did that in part, I believe. N.F. Thompson did that in part to point out how there's less labor activism, fewer strikes in the South. And so I think that's really key.
And what reasons did people like Thompson give for this claim that the South, or most of the South, was comparatively calm and harmonious with respect to labor management relations in comparison with the North?
I point out that there are probably at least two reasons why Southern boosters argued that the South was better from a business perspective than the North. The first is that there's this idea, and I don't know if it's necessarily true, but certainly Southern boosters promoted it, and that is that the relationship between management and workers was more harmonious, right? These textile mills, there's this idea that the employers are more benevolent, more paternalistic, and there's less resistance on the shop floor. The second reason is racism. You have a segmented labor force. You have employers refusing to hire African Americans for certain jobs, but then also threatening white workers who might want to strike, might want to get active, that, hey, how would you like it if a black person took your job? And really deliberately fanning the flames of racial tension. It's a classic kind of divide and conquer. Nothing necessarily new in this period, but I've encountered some evidence where employers were very explicit about pitting blacks against whites. So the two basic reasons, the supposed benevolence of the Southern employers and the persistence of racism in workplaces.
Was there a difference or perceived difference among these employers in terms of, you know, black workers are more or less likely than white workers to, for example, join a union, to become militant, to demand things in an organized way?
Yeah, so the labor movement's record on race is really mixed. There's a lot of unions would not organize with African Americans, not all, but many. And employers realize this, and so they say, you know what, this is great. The best thing about these black workers is that they won't join a union. And the reason they don't join unions is in part because of the discrimination of the unions themselves, but also because there are black elites who discourage African Americans from joining unions as well. And I talk about some of them as well. Some of them have relationships with N.F. Thompson, in fact.
His name is Chad Pearson. He teaches history at Collin College in Plano, Texas. And his new book is Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. We'll take a short break and speak more with Chad. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The book is Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. It's just out from the University of Pennsylvania Press. And its author, Chad Pearson, joins me in studio. He's a professor of history at Collin College. And I should say we have a link to his book, Reform or Repression, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Okay, so you were talking before the break about the fact that these employers, many of whom were racist, could count on certain African-American leaders, community leaders, maybe even so-called reformers, to advance their anti-union agenda, to support it, to maybe even tell African-Americans in the workplace not to join unions or to tell them that unions were not worth joining. For example, in your book, you bring up two black leaders, one very famous, Booker T. Washington, head of the Tuskegee Institute in southern Alabama, and also a guy named William Council, president of the Alabama Agricultural and Mechanical College, both African Americans. So what did Thompson learn about these two men and the degree to which he might ally with them in his open shop movement activities?
Well, William H. Council, I think, is very important and perhaps less well known in American history. In 1887, he wrote a short pamphlet called The Negro Laborer, A Word to Him. And he was basically in this pamphlet talked about how unions are bad, strikes are wrong, never drink at work, labor unions are worse than slavery. He himself is a former slave, right? As was Booker T. Washington. So both Council and Washington collaborated with N.F. Thompson. N.F. Thompson organized a number of Southern industrial conferences. The first one was in Huntsville, Alabama in 1899, and Council and Washington came and spoke. And basically their audience consisted of investors, Southern industrialists, powerful, privileged people. And they basically said to them, hey, look, you know, the African-American community is not going to join unions, not going to strike. We are very much in favor of supporting law and order efforts. Council also advocated vagrancy laws, as did N.F. Thompson. Now, these are interesting, and vagrancy laws seem inconsistent with the open shop principle, because the open shop principle suggests that workers should have the right to go from job to job, to enter the labor force as they see fit. But vagrancy laws are laws designed to arrest those who were not working, and many authorities targeted African Americans and forced them often to work in, say, coal mines or to pick crops and that sort of thing. So both Thompson and Council pledged their support for the open shop principle, but also talked about their support for vagrancy laws.
So why would Booker T. Washington and William H. Council, why would they promote this scenario of, you know, blacks being deferential laborers and sober and respectful of private property? I mean, what was their overall agenda into which this idea of how blacks ought to work and how they ought to behave fit?
Well, certainly this is a time when, well, they were academic administrators. They were presidents of their colleges. So certainly the students there would need jobs. And so what they did was they signaled to potential employers that these are deferential workers. They're not going to rock the boat. Hire them. You know, they're not going to demonstrate any kind of insubordination, right? So they had a material interest in seeing that their students got these jobs.
And it's also true that Booker T. Washington, he was very interested in the sort of like the kind of the self-empowerment and self-development of black communities, correct?
That's right. That's right. And labor unions were, you know, he was very much opposed to them. And there's evidence, or some folks have suggested that he was involved in helping employers break strikes with African-American laborers. So, yeah, no, he was no friend of organized labor, certainly.
Well, you know, we've been talking about how N.F. Thompson, again, one of the South's most visible opponent. He was nationally recognized, really, opponent of labor unions and labor organizing, about how he and his allies tried to portray the South as relatively harmonious on the labor level, on the racial level. What was the reality? I mean, what was the truth as far as labor militancy in the South, instances of strikes or picketing or just plain militant activity on the part of workers?
The story's mixed. I think it's fair to say that there was probably less labor militancy, but that doesn't mean there was no labor militancy. You have these big longshore strikes. You have strikes in coal mines. You have strikes sugar agricultural workers. So N.F. Thompson, who edited a Southern boosterish newspaper, tended to downplay this for obvious reasons, because he wanted to attract investment. But there were various strikes and labor organizing activities. It just didn't serve his interest to focus on those.
And do we know whether black workers participated in any of these labor actions in the South in any numbers?
Yeah, absolutely. There were black workers who were involved in longshore strikes, in coal mining strikes. Earlier on in the late 19th century, they're involved in sugar worker strikes in Louisiana. So black workers were very much involved, despite what Booker T. Washington or William Council or N.F. Thompson said. Many did support labor unions.
And what this means is that I would think at least some of the Northerners that N.F. Thompson was trying to attract to the South, I would think at least some of them kind of knew some of this stuff. So maybe they were less inclined to believe Mr. Thompson's story about, hey, how the American South is so conflict-free in the labor area.
That's true. I think there were Northern liberal types, though, who tended to focus on a lot of the racial strife in the South. And that's something that really bothered N.F. Thompson. Of course, in the late 19th century, there was a number of high-profile lynching cases. And N.F. Thompson defended lynching against so-called lawbreakers. He didn't think lynching was necessary for all African Americans, most of whom were law-abiding, as he pointed out, you know, given his relationship with Booker T. Washington and William Council. But there was a moment when a group called the American Anti-Lynching League went south and helped bring up the Baker family to Boston. The Baker family, the father, Frazier Baker, was lynched. He was a postmaster in South Carolina. And N.F. Thompson thought that the effort to denounce the South based on lynching was exaggerated, and that these northern do-gooders, these liberals, didn't really know what they were talking about.
So is there a parallel here between the way Thompson saw the Klan being kind of a force for law and order and the way he viewed lynchers as possibly being that same defender of the traditional way of life and defending stability in communities?
Absolutely, absolutely. He sees lynching against so-called lawbreaking as justifiable.
We're talking with Chad Pearson about his book, Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. And as I said earlier, we're focusing on a chapter in this book, one of the case studies that Chad presents in this book, that focuses on N.F. Thompson, who was a New South booster and a very strong-minded union opponent who got a lot of national recognition. And his story reveals a lot to me, and I'm sure as well to Chad, about the relationship between vigilantism and racial violence on the one hand and early 20th century anti-union activism on the other. And his story also reveals how the American South was portrayed in stark contrast to the North as a place of labor management harmony that did not need or want labor organizing. And, you know, we'll talk about the legacy of that message a little later this hour, but certainly that kind of division between North and South, there's some validity to that. So are you telling me that N.F. Thompson was bothered more by disgruntled workers getting organized and asserting themselves in the North than by Ku Klux Klan activity and lynchings in the South?
He certainly thought that labor activism in the North was much worse, and he drew this stark contrast at one point after this woman named Lillian Jewett, a woman who helped bring this family, the Baker family, north. He said, you know, I have no business going to Cleveland, where he witnessed a big streetcar strike, and saying, hey, look at these workers. They're so out of control. I'm going to save them, right? But you, Lillian Clayton Jewett, can go south and protect these people. You don't know anything about the causes of lynching, right? And he talks about how, you know, before the Civil War, you didn't have black men assaulting white women, right? Which is one of the main reasons why, or allegedly why, you have these lynchings. And so he drew a stark contrast, and he did so because he basically wanted to send a message to prospective investors that the northern labor problem is considerably worse than the southern race problem.
How good did Thompson become in recruiting investors and capitalists to places like Birmingham and Huntsville, Alabama?
I don't have hard numbers, but anecdotally, he talked about meeting with many people. There were newspaper accounts that referred to Huntsville as the Manchester of the South. That is, it attracted a lot of textile mills. Now, this is at a time when Thompson was head of the Thompson Land and Investment Company, and he was also secretary of the Huntsville Chamber of Commerce. So he was able to attract these businesses south by arguing that it was relatively free of labor strife. He also did that in Birmingham, and he was editor of a journal called The Tradesman, which was one of the biggest, most influential Southern booster publications. And this covered throughout the South. And here he would talk about all the investment. But I think he wasn't entirely happy with all the investment. He wanted to see more. And he continued to tout the agriculture, you know, the land possibilities, the cheap land, the low labor costs, and of course, the availability of open shop workplaces.
We also need to talk about the dimension of Thompson's thinking in relation to immigrants. So he perceived working class immigrants to be very active in both labor strife and in kind of labor politics in the North. Talk about that.
That's right. And he saw that immigrants were inclined to join anarchists, were active in electing pro-labor politicians, were inclined to go on strike. And there are times when he prefers African-American workers over immigrant workers because he saw them as more deferential.
So N.F. Thompson, again, the focus of one chapter of the book, Reform or Repression, by my guest Chad Pearson, who teaches history at Collin College in Texas. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We have a link to Chad's book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So N.F. Thompson, this major figure, this really kind of national figure in terms of opposing labor unions and labor organizing in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He helped lobby the Alabama legislature to pass what was called the Individual Rights Bill. What did this 1903 law provide?
This basically made it illegal for anyone to interfere with an employer who wanted to hire non-union workers. It made it illegal to boycott certain businesses because they were not union. And so this law got a lot of praise from those in the national anti-union, that is the National Open Shop Movement, and other states saw this law as a model, including Colorado, and passed similar anti-boycott laws. So Thompson was critical in getting this legislation, and it inspired others involved in the anti-union movement.
Tell us about the National Civic Federation and Thompson's views toward it.
The National Civic Federation was a joint employer union, and it also had members of the nebulous general public. It was more moderate than some of the more aggressive employers' associations like the National Association of Manufacturers, but it was sort of a reformist group, and they had investigators who went south investigating child labor, and N.F. Thompson was very annoyed by it because he thought that these Southern businesses should be able to employ whomever, and that this was none of their business to come south and to investigate what he called Southern outrages. They called these Southern outrages. He thought this was unnecessary.
So he supported child labor?
He doesn't come out and state it explicitly, but he certainly did not like any outside force coming in and investigating it.
So sum up for us then why the life and activities of N.F. Thompson interest you so much, why you wrote so much about him, why is he important in U.S. history, and what kind of impact do you think he might have had on the development of the South and the way it viewed labor unions, maybe even after his death?
I think he's fascinating because of the long history here. He starts as a Klansman, and he ends his life as a very active anti-union figure. He really went out of his way to distinguish the South from the North, exaggerated quite a bit, but promoted this idea that the South was a bastion of anti-unionism. That message is very much with us today. When you look at the South, and most Southern states are so-called right to work, that is, it's harder for unions to organize. This is a phenomenon that begins well before anti-labor legislation like the Taft-Hartley Act comes into play in 1947. It was N.F. Thompson who helped promote the South as a region of good for business, not at all good for labor. And so I think he did a lot in the area of connecting issues of race and management, right? Going back to his Klan days into the Progressive Era, and that remains an issue to this day.
And your analysis also suggests that we really can't understand anti-union activism in the South without understanding race relations, race conflicts, potential race conflicts, and also Reconstruction and how that was viewed by people in the South, and how many people in the South, many whites in the South, were felt threatened by this prospect of disobedient free blacks and what they might do to industry and community in the South.
Right. That's absolutely right. I see much continuity from Reconstruction up through the Progressive period.
And we have time to talk briefly about some of the other chapters in this book, Reform or Repression, by my guest, history professor Chad Pearson. So one of your chapters focuses on Cleveland. Why did you choose that city?
I chose Cleveland because it's known as a progressive city. It had a very liberal mayor named Tom Johnson, who talked about championing the rights of the people against the corporations, the businesses, but also because I looked at two figures who were very active in the anti-union movement, one of whom started his career as a labor union activist, a president of his union, a guy by the name of John Penton. And at the end of his career, he worked for employers associations and was active in recruiting strikebreakers and busting unions. And he worked with a guy named J.P. Dawley. J.P. Dawley was the president of the Cleveland Employers Association. He was a lawyer and edited the Cleveland Employers Association's newspaper called the Facts. It's called Facts. But he, at the end of his career in 1911, he switched sides and began supporting a union. He was the lawyer for a garment workers union in 1911 during this big strike. And so I call it a tale of two men, class traitors in Cleveland, looking at, again, John A. Penton, who was a union guy, union president turned union buster, and then J.P. Dawley, a union buster who became sympathetic to organized labor.
What about Buffalo, the site of another of your case studies in this book? What happened there that you found compelling and illustrative?
So Buffalo was home of the Pan American Exposition in 1901, this massive World's Fair type thing. It was infamous because it's where Leon Czolgosz, an anarchist, shot and killed President William McKinley. And this was a real embarrassment for the civic leaders, for the business leaders in Buffalo. And so I look at how those business leaders, those employers, particularly those who ran foundries, responded. And I focus on this big strike in 1906. What's interesting here is that one of the jurors, the head juror, who sent Leon Czolgosz to the electric chair was a guy named Henry Wendt. Henry Wendt was a foundry operator, and he was very active in a group called the National Founders Association. Well, he was very much active in breaking this 1906 strike. And so I refer to this chapter as, I call it Avenging McKinley, because he sent Czolgosz to the electric chair, and then, of course, he helped bust this big strike in 1906.
And were Buffalo's politics back then kind of progressive on the same level as Cleveland's?
Yes, they refer to themselves as the progressive employers. Buffalo employers and spokespersons called their city the Queen City, and they had not a lot of very nice things to say about themselves. Whether it was progressive on the ground is another story. I think workers probably did not think so.
And then Worcester, Mass., and in fact, I think you grew up in New England. Why are the open shop campaigns in that city discussed in your book?
Worcester had a very sizable chapter of a group called the National Metal Trades Association. Members of this organization had a very successful labor bureau. This is a kind of a blacklisting technique where you have a centralized office that would hire workers. They would look at their background and make sure they didn't have any labor union activity in their background and would hire them, and would also, the person who controlled the labor bureau, the secretary, would also keep lists of those who were insubordinate or active in labor unions. And so this was one of the most successful labor bureaus in the National Metal Trades Association, so successful that employers as far away as Australia learned about it and wrote Worcester about how they manage the so-called labor problem. Worcester is also important because the National Metal Trades Association held their conference there in 1914. And one of the spokespersons for that chapter's National Metal Trades Association, a guy by the name of Donald Tulloch, talked about how there's labor peace in Worcester. He predicted a strikeless future. Everything is wonderful. Well, a little bit more than a year later, there's this massive 3,000-person strike in Worcester. And so a big public relations disaster for them. So the myth about the happy worker is something that we see in all of these cases, but it's especially pronounced in Worcester.
For this book, you did a lot of deep research into the arguments waged by open shop proponents, right? Arguments made by people who want to demonize labor unions as un-American, as enemies of the common people, as enemies of freedom. I wonder to what degree you see parallels to today's anti-union movement. Are there arguments that have been consistently used and utilized over time, or has the argumentative stance, the rhetorical stance of current-day anti-union activists, has it departed from what was said a century or more ago?
I see a lot of continuities here. Today, like we saw in the progressive period, the so-called progressive period, you have employers and their allies who talk a lot about the rights of individuals, talk a lot about unions as intrusive third parties that undermine the natural relationship between employers and workers. These sorts of arguments go back really far, that they'll force workers to go on strike, that they're naturally combative. These sorts of arguments come out again and again, and so I definitely see continuity.
And what about, because one thing we haven't talked with you about is your emphasis on the role of public relations in sort of disseminating and developing the ideas of the anti-union activist movements of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Do you see PR being similarly a key driving force behind the anti-labor organizing forces today?
Absolutely. What's interesting about the progressive period is that you have spokespersons who they seek to protect the common people as opposed to denounce the dangerous classes, right? We see a lot of talk about the dangerous classes in the 19th century, and we see a shift. All of a sudden, it's about protecting the rights of the non-union worker. And so today, very much what I see is are a lot of these anti-union consultants, lawyers, human resources folks who talk a lot about individual rights, talk about the union, again, as a sort of third party, as an intrusive force. And so those arguments really go back to the early 20th century.
And maybe this is an obvious question, but why are such arguments so appealing to the general public? Why are they able to gain purchase to the degree they do? You know, with people's attitudes, people's convictions, people's understanding of how labor works and how management treats them?
I guess, you know, there's this deep streak of individualism. I don't know if everybody buys into that, but certainly it's there.
Chad Pearson is his name, professor of history at Collin College in Texas, and his new book is Reform or Repression, Organizing America's Anti-Union Movement. It's published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Chad, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.